Hello, I'm Jim Ellis, President and CEO of the Alberta Energy Regulator. On our path to regulatory excellence, we are striving to create a new relationship with Indigenous peoples, one built on mutual understanding and trust. Voices of Understanding, Looking Through the Window, acknowledges the very different ways that Indigenous cultures and Western cultures look at the world. To help us understand how to appreciate those different views, this book explains Indigenous and Western decision-making models and explores the ways that we can come together. We couldn't write a book like this on our own. It is difficult to admit that you don't have all the answers, or that the answers you have are incomplete. Recognizing that your worldview is not the only valid vantage point is, quite frankly, humbling. To acknowledge this requires an open mind, respect, and trust in those who teach us. For many months, a team of Alberta Energy Regulator employees worked with Dr. Reg Croshew, a Blackfoot elder, to learn how our organization can better respect the knowledge and cultures of Indigenous communities. We know that the decision-making models that the AER uses and the decision-making models used by Indigenous communities are not mutually understood, but making decisions is an important part of being a regulator. We are tasked day in and day out with considering applications and making decisions that are fair and informed. To help us approach this in a way that's respectful of Indigenous communities, Dr. Croshew introduced us to Blackfoot decision-making circles, traditionally used to make decisions within communities by providing participants equal opportunity to have a say. Dr. Croshew taught us how Blackfoot decision-making circles reflect Indigenous worldviews and how those can be reflected in decisions we make with our Western view. Dr. Croshew also taught us about ethical spaces, spaces that are created when two distinct, complementary worldviews are acknowledged equally. Voices of Understanding tells the stories of two groups divided by a wall. Rather than allowing that divide to alienate them, the book shows how each group has an equal opportunity to look through a window and better understand the other before walking through a door to make shared decisions. Only when both have looked through the window to understand each other's customs and worldviews can either comprehend what to do when they pass through the door. So often, we think we can charge ahead. To not run to the door takes mindfulness, respect, and discipline. This journey reminded us to not assume, but to listen. I owe great thanks to Reg and Rose Croshew, whose insights and contributions to this book have been invaluable. In a ceremony led by Dr. Croshew and elders Rose Croshew, Mike Beaver, and Richard Lightning, I received a bundle representing the teaching from the Voices of Understanding process. In receiving the bundle, I accepted the responsibility to share and apply the knowledge they gave us to our future work. This is a story I'm glad to tell and one that I endorse. These teachings will support our mandate and guide our work as we apply this knowledge to the AER's current and future strategic plans. To those in the industry we regulate, I ask you to read this with an open mind. This is not a regulatory document, but an opportunity to do things differently. We will gain a better understanding with every learning opportunity before us. I have high hopes for the discussions ahead, and I ask you to look through the window as we are learning to. Thank you.
Hi, this is Kara Tobin with Public Affairs, and this is Acknowledgements. The Alberta Energy Regulator, known as the AER, acknowledges the guidance and insight provided by Dr. Reg Croshew and Rose Croshew, Piikani Nation elders from Treaty 7 territory. Their teachings are the foundation of this book. Elder Mike Beaver from Big Stone Cree Nation in Treaty 8 territory and Elder Richard Lightning from Ermineskin Cree Nation in Treaty 6 territory, supported Reg and Rose in the pipe ceremony associated with this book. The feedback and direction they provided assisted in refining our learnings. Many AER employees participated in the journey to create this book, and many more will be involved as we work to raise awareness of the concepts discussed in Voices of Understanding. The AER project team specifically involved in creating this book was initially coordinated by Anna Rose, Alternative Dispute Resolution Practice Lead. Her desire to see Indigenous communities feel welcomed into AER processes was the motivation for this book. Arlette Malcolm, Director of Indigenous and Regional Engagement, provided strategic leadership that advanced development of this book. Denise Parsons, Senior Advisor with Alberta Stakeholder Engagement, undertook writing and coordination aspects of Voices of Understanding with the support and guidance of a project team that included the following individuals: Dean Campbell, Senior Hearing Advisor; Carol Covey, Advisor, Area-Based Regulation; Doreen Healy, Indigenous Engagement Specialist; Corrine Lawrence, Alternative Dispute Resolution Specialist; Barbara McNeil, Hearing Commissioner; Kara Tobin, Manager, Public Affairs; Jason Vaness, Senior Strategic Advisor, Alberta Stakeholder Engagement. Editing was provided by Ken Bonnet, Senior Editor, and Natalie Brodich, Advisor, provided communications support. The AER's executive leadership team endorsed Voices of Understanding from the outset. The participation of the AER's President and CEO, Chief Hearing Commissioner, and Executive Vice Presidents in the pipe ceremony associated with this book, along with the project team, demonstrates the AER's commitment to this project.
Hi, I'm Arlette Malcolm. I'm with Alberta Stakeholder Engagement. Forward, what we hope to achieve. When the AER and Dr. Reg Croshew initiated this journey in 2003 with the development of the first edition of Voices of Understanding decision-making tools, our intent was to create a learning kit for youth. We wanted to foster cross-cultural understanding, share information about the regulator, and promote an interactive learning environment. When the AER considered developing a second edition of Voices of Understanding, we sought to clarify our intent. What did we hope to achieve with this new book? Our initial thoughts included the following. We are motivated by our commitment to regulatory excellence, which includes utmost integrity, empathic engagement, and stellar competence. And we want to demonstrate these attributes when working with Indigenous communities. We recognize that the decision-making approaches of the Alberta Energy Regulator and Indigenous communities are not mutually understood. Finding ways to meaningfully engage with Indigenous communities will help us to become a better regulator. We want to compare alternative dispute resolution and hearing processes to Indigenous decision-making approaches to build understanding of how they can be complementary processes. With these intentions in mind, we reached out to Dr. Reg Croshew and his wife and fellow elder, Rose. Reg and Rose are elders in the Blackfoot community and members of Piikani Nation. They guided development of the first edition of Voices of Understanding. We asked Reg to share his hopes for a new edition of Voices of Understanding, and he emphasized two outcomes. One, that orally transmitted Indigenous knowledge about decision-making be documented, because Indigenous youth now predominantly interact with the written word, and oral traditions are being lost. Two, that the teachings shared with us would support the creation of ethical spaces that would allow Indigenous communities and non-Indigenous communities to see each other's perspectives and to choose to work together in those spaces. At first glance, the intentions of the AER and the hopes Reg expressed seemed poorly aligned. However, through the exercise of looking through the window, as will be explained later in this book, we found the link. We discovered a door that we can open and thereby enter an ethical space that allows us to work together.
Hi, I'm Jason Vaness, and I'm with the Indigenous Relations Group with the Alberta Energy Regulator. And this is We Are on a Journey. For several days, AER staff listened, asked questions, and sought to understand what Reg was sharing with us. Eventually, we realized that there are many opportunities to learn and apply the teachings Reg and Rose were sharing. Part of our journey is accepting that we don't have all the answers, and that we may not have understood some things. We acknowledge that this book and the processes we participated in to develop it are part of a journey. It reflects what we understood at a specific point in time, and our understanding will continue to evolve. This is okay. Prompting discussion and learning is the overarching theme of Voices of Understanding. There are many more discussions to be had. Sharing what we learned with other AER staff, decision makers, and people working with processes that involve Indigenous communities is a continuation of our journey. Application. The intentions of Voices of Understanding, looking through the window, would not be met if we assumed that the insights described in this book apply to all Indigenous communities or to all leadership systems. First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities and peoples each have unique and complex processes, protocols, and expectations that we must seek to understand. The way that elected and hereditary leaders in Indigenous communities approach governance and decision-making may differ from the way that other leadership, as provided by elders or other knowledge holders, approach governance and decision-making in a community. The concepts presented in Voices of Understanding are open to interpretation and are not intended to impose a specific approach on the leadership of Indigenous communities or the way the AER and Indigenous communities can work together. Likewise, Voices of Understanding does not impose a prescriptive approach on the industry the AER regulates. Some companies may already embrace the concepts described in this book. For other companies, as it has for the AER, Voices of Understanding can provide insights into the benefits of exploring different ways of engaging Indigenous communities, including strengthening relationships and helping to prevent or resolve disputes. As is the case in most walks of life, working together in a meaningful way results in the most success. Terminology. The terms used to describe people and organizations can be a source of confusion and tension. While the term Indigenous may be used predominantly in this book, Reg often referred to First Nation when he spoke, and sometimes he included a reference to Métis communities or to Aboriginal people. There are concepts he felt were applicable to all oral cultures and others that were specific to only his community. Different terms are used throughout this book, and our intention is simply to reflect what Reg expressed to us. Translation. Concepts discussed in this book are not always easily defined terms that have a direct translation from Blackfoot to English. We came to realize that, like the multiple Inuit words for snow, many Blackfoot terms associated with a decision-making circle do not have a direct translation to English. A decision-making circle is not a singular concept. It is multifaceted, and several English terms could be used to describe it, including a process, a model, a protocol, or a system. We encountered this many times in our discussions with Reg, and he illustrated the challenge of translation and the associated confusion that can occur with the following story. Our elders have a word for popcorn. Because popcorn looks like a bowl of clouds, in our original Blackfoot language, we call popcorn cloud food. Our young people, who are taught Blackfoot in school based on a curriculum developed within a Western context, are taught to literally translate pop, which means small explosion, and corn, which means looks like teeth, into a Blackfoot word for popcorn. So when the young people speak about popcorn, the elders laugh because what they are hearing is exploding teeth. Similar to Reg's example about popcorn, the Blackfoot concepts of decision-making circles, ethical spaces, and other terms are not easily translatable. We sought to reflect what Reg taught us, and in so doing, there is not always a continuity of terminology throughout this book. This is because there are not literal interpretations available for some of the concepts we discussed. Our intent is to capture the richness of the concepts Reg shared, and this sometimes required using several terms for what might seem like a singular concept. What we learned from Reg is that we shouldn't get caught up in these terms and ways of labeling people and concepts. We need to get on with creating ethical spaces, and in doing so, the relevance of terminology will become apparent. Who are we to tell this story? We are sharing it because we are obliged to, which is not a burden, but an acceptance of a responsibility. We recognize now that when we asked for Reg's insights, we were also receiving the responsibility for carrying forward his teachings. Advancing regulatory excellence means that we accept this responsibility as a reflection of our mandate, and that we carry it forward in our strategic planning and in our approach to developing and implementing new regulatory tools. In Blackfoot culture, bundles are associated with ceremonies, societies, and individuals. Bundles have both physical and abstract aspects that convey a vision, a mandate, and a story. We are bound by a bundle transferred to the AER through ceremony. This bundle represents knowledge and the privilege given to the AER to tell this story. We are now responsible for sharing this story by building awareness within the AER and externally of what Reg has taught us.
Hi, I'm Doreen Healy with the Enterprise Engagement Group. And on January 31st, Dr. Reg Kroshu and three elders from Treaty 6, 7, and 8 territories hosted a ceremony at the AER. The event acknowledged the work behind this edition of Voices of Understanding and also ceremoniously granted the AER the right to use this shared knowledge. During this ceremony, Reg transferred a bundle to Jim Ellis, President and Chief Executive Officer at the AER. Jim received the bundle, and in so doing, he accepted the responsibility to share and apply the knowledge we have gained.
Hi, my name is Anna Rose, formerly of Alberta Stakeholder Engagement, and this is the introduction. Ethical space may not be a familiar term. It is a new concept for the AER, and it is not easy to define. When we work to understand a perspective that is different from our own, and then examine the understanding with an eye to find connections with our own perspective or our own worldview, we begin to create an ethical space. The key is to link these worldviews in a way that does not diminish either and that honors both. This new way, which reflects a deep understanding of varying perspectives and values, can result in an ethical space that transforms the way we work together. The first edition of Voices of Understanding, Decision-Making Tools, was our first encounter, our first attempt to understand each other. Reg shared his perspective. The book was a written story, and the audio tape was the oral story, but we never connected or linked them. Like an IBM and a Mac, we can't mix them together or they'll crash, but we can link them. We have cords and cables to connect them. This is what we were trying to achieve. The second edition is going to talk about building the foundation of linking the two. This statement by Reg illustrated the evolution of our learning. Our first attempt, Voices of Understanding, Decision-Making Tools, presented two unlinked narratives, Blackfoot decision-making circles and Alberta Energy Regulator hearings. This, our second attempt, C seeks to connect oral and written concepts. To make connections, we discussed two aspects of Indigenous and Western cultures: worldviews, decision-making models. Weaved through our discussion with Reg about worldviews and decision-making models were our attempts to find connections. We ventured to link worldviews, then we sought to link decision-making models. As we move through this book and think about linkages, Reg cautioned us not to look for ways to integrate our worldviews and associated processes, but to link them. Reg emphasized the significance of this linking exercise, and we came to understand the importance of a window through which we can see two sides, and of a door that we can open to enter a new space, an ethical space. This doesn't mean we take pieces of Western cultures and parts of Indigenous cultures and try to blend them together. Rather, we consider both cultures, and when we have enough understanding to see the connections, we are able to create a new ethical space where we can tell a new shared story that links two systems. This new story is represented by the bundle, Reg transferred to the AER, which contains this book.
Hi, my name is Denise Parsons. I'm with the Alberta Stakeholder Engagement Group. This section is called Worldviews, Knowledge Systems. The lens through which we see the world is often considered our worldview. Our ideas, attitudes, knowledge, and opinions influence our worldview. As a regulator, worldviews are not something we often consider when doing our work and seeking to fulfill our mandate. Yet we found ourselves in a discussion with Reg about how we see the world, what underlying assumptions guide our approaches, and how worldviews influence learning and decision-making. This discussion was crucial for reaching a level of understanding that allowed us to find connections. We sought to connect, or as Reg described it, link, worldviews so that we could establish a foundation of mutual understanding and trust. This foundation allowed us to approach discussions about decision-making models with an improved understanding of how worldviews influence the models we use and the decisions we make. When we sat down with Reg and Rose to discuss this book and affirm our shared objectives, we cited AER values, as identified in the AER strategic plan, and expressed a desire to address specific aspects of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and the work of the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation Canada. Reg used our approach to illustrate a worldview. He pointed out that these written books are the authorities that we were drawing from to rationalize the creation of this book. Reg also pointed out that the end product would be another written book that aligned with a Western worldview that values documentation. This discussion with Reg identified how our approach to this book reflected a worldview where truth is evident because it has been documented in a written text. Reg said, "If we look at the dominant society and the Western knowledge base that exists, we access it from a Western written system. So whether it's management systems or education systems, it's a written management system that we need to navigate to get rights or privileges to add to that knowledge base, and the products that come out are written books. However, there is another approach, traditional knowledge, that reflects an Indigenous worldview." Reg explained that traditional knowledge is an oral management system that we also need to address. He said, "As we navigate that oral system and the associated protocols, then we can get rights or privileges that add to traditional knowledge." The products of an oral system are stories and songs that are documentation or proof of knowledge and of what was learned. Reg encouraged us to link these two systems. Linking these systems forms a foundation. Reg told us, It's the systems we have to link. We use Western written systems, and we try to access traditional knowledge. But you can't, because it's like a square peg into a round hole. It doesn't fit. So many times we've tried that. The first edition of Voices of Understanding was looking at how we might use written systems to access traditional knowledge. But now I think that we're at a level that we have to understand that there is an oral system, and we need to link the systems, because linking those two systems allows for a foundation. This section gives an overview of an Indigenous worldview supported by an oral system, and it provides information about a Western worldview and the associated written system that supports this worldview. With a base level of information in hand, we then examine links between our worldviews and discuss the creation of ethical spaces.
Hi, I'm Barbara McNeil. I was a hearing commissioner with the Alberta Energy Regulator. Indigenous oral systems. The premise of an Indigenous worldview that Red shared with us is that of equality, with humans as equal to all creations, with knowledge shared through oral systems, and with authority grounded in stewardship and authenticated through songs. In an Indigenous worldview, there are seven sacred teachings that come from the Creator. These seven sacred teachings, which are natural laws and behavioral expectations, were described by Reg as being comparable to an organization's code of ethics. Respect, love, courage or bravery, truth, honesty, humility, wisdom. In Blackfoot culture, these sacred teachings are embedded in stories. There are similar stories in other Indigenous cultures that Reg encouraged us to examine. Reg explained to us that in his community, storytelling is a way of passing information from generation to generation. Indigenous people often use storytelling and oral teaching methods to transmit knowledge to youth, including information about the past and the way things are today, and to illustrate important lessons about life. This is traditional knowledge. The information, evidence, experiences, and beliefs embedded in orally transmitted stories that reflect the collective knowledge of a community and a culture. These stories reflect the seven natural laws and often depict a close relationship with nature rather than control over the natural world. All creatures and things are equal and connected. These stories use images to teach not only about relationships between people, but also about relationships between people and nature. The stories and associated details contain knowledge. The knowledge associated with an oral system is often referred to as traditional knowledge and is obtained through an adherence to processes and protocols. On the other side is TK, traditional knowledge base. On that side, the traditional knowledge side, there is an oral management system that we also need to navigate. And as we navigate that oral system, then we get rights or privileges that add to traditional knowledge. And the products that come out of that oral system are stories and songs that are physical documentations. I might have a story that adds to the knowledge base, but the song validates it as real. Or I might have a song that allows me the privilege to access traditional knowledge. It's that oral management system, complete with protocols, that we have to navigate. Not just anyone can tell these stories. The position of storyteller is highly respected because it is given to an individual who has gained specific knowledge and who has been granted the right to tell a story. This responsibility can be transferred to others once they have gained the required knowledge and expertise. A specific object, such as a bundle that contains significant cultural material, physically symbolizes authority, similar to a degree certificate a person receives upon graduation from university. If a person is not authorized to tell a story or discuss a certain process but does so, they could face serious repercussions, such as embarrassment in the community or segregation. The purpose of this restriction is to ensure that the knowledge base remains consistent. A parallel example would be the repercussions of practicing law without a degree. When a request is made for a decision, the request may come from the external environment as information in the form of a sensor story. The information contained in the sensor story is discussed within the decision-making circle by those with the appropriate knowledge. Knowledge holders consider the sensor story in the context of the standards and norms reflected in stories. In our way, in our oral culture, it's retelling the stories so that when people come in with information, the elders usually sit together in a circle and they all have standards and norms that they hold as stories. So when someone comes in with a story, then they measure it and compare it to those norms and standards. After an introduced sensor story has been explored, a new story may be created or an existing one changed. This validation process allows for formal control and preservation of oral knowledge while also remaining adaptive to change.
The story of Nappy and the mice illustrates how there are rules and protocols associated with an oral tradition. Reg shared this story with us. Nappy and the mice. Because Nappy was being left out of the activities of the camp in which he was currently staying, he decided that it was time for him to leave and go out on his own again. Nappy never worried about where he was going to sleep or when he was going to eat until that time arrived. So off he went traveling all that day. It was getting a little late, so Nappy made his way down to one of the rivers to spend the night. During the evening, Nappy was having trouble sleeping because his legs were sore and bothering him. Late in the night, when he was just about asleep, he started to hear voices. He thought that it was just because he was tired, but the voices kept on, and they got louder. Finally, Nappy got up and decided to find out where the voices were coming from. He went towards the sound, every once in a while stopping to listen for the direction it was coming from. Nappy crept along the edges of some bushes, careful not to make a sound. He spotted something white. As he got closer, he realized it was a sun-bleached elk skull. The noises were coming from the skull. Nappy crawled ever so slowly, reached the elk skull without even so much as cracking a dry blade of grass. He peeked into the eye of the elk skull and was amazed at what he saw. Little mice were inside of the elk skull, dancing and singing. With their little paws up to their little cheeks, they were jumping up and down on their little feet, singing as they danced in a circle. Over and over they sang, taking little breaks to catch their wind. Then back to singing and dancing they went. Nappy wanted to join them. So Nappy went back to fetch his robe and approached the skull. With his old, old familiar wail, he said, "Ay, ay, ay, niska nuk u ni nagu kawa its auhe. Ay, 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 little brothers, what are you doing? Let me do it too." When one of the older mice peeked out from the skull and saw Nappy coming, he told the rest of them, "It's only our big brother Nappy. He's crying to join our dance." Without any further discussion, all of the mice agreed to let Nappy join them in their little dance. Nappy was too big for the skull, so the leader of the mice told Nappy that he could only put his head through the neck part of the skull and that this had to be done by the mice's magic. Once inside, he could sway his head back and forth to the tune of the singing and dancing. That was all right with Nappy. The leader of the mice told Nappy, "You are not one of us. We have a restriction for those who aren't one of us. We dance for 4 nights. This is only the first night. At daybreak, we disperse until night falls again. We continue this way until after 4 nights, and then we go our separate ways. Through all of these nights, you must not fall asleep, or bad things shall happen to you. We will have to leave your head in this skull until after the last night, and then we will let your head out of here. Don't fall asleep while we are dancing at night. Beware." So Nappy agreed, And once again, the mice began dancing and singing while Nappy moved his head back and forth and to the sides, keeping with the rhythm of the mice music. Nappy was having the time of his life. At daybreak, the mice all left. Nappy fell asleep with his head inside of the elk skull, and all day he slept like a dead thing. Nappy would have slept on, but the mice woke him up as they were coming in, talking excitedly in their happy voices. Again, they danced and sang through the night, with Nappy doing his part by bobbing his head in time with the music. Once more, daylight came and the mice dispersed for the coming day, leaving Nappy all alone. This went on for two more nights. On the beginning of the fourth day, Nappy couldn't sleep because he was awfully tired of lying on his stomach. While he was trying to sleep, the mice came back for their last day of dancing and singing. Sometime during the mice's singing and dancing, Nappy fell asleep, and the bad things the mice had mentioned to Nappy had to be carried out. So the mice chewed off all of Nappy's hair. When Nappy woke up, the mice were all gone, and he couldn't get his head out of the old bleached elk skull. To make matters worse, he couldn't see where he was going. So he got up with the elk skull on his head, feeling his way this way and that way. As he was groping around, Nappy fell into a river. There he was, floating down the river, bobbing out of sight with the elk skull still on his head. Nappy didn't know how long he was in the river, floating with the current, when some women, who were cleaning fresh entrails from a buffalo, getting them ready to eat, spotted the elk skull floating towards them. One woman screamed out, "Here comes an elk swimming down the river!" The women hurried to the river, pulled the skull to the shore, only to find that it was a man with his head stuck inside an elk skull. They helped him further and broke the skull off of Nappy's head with a stone hammer. As the skull broke free, the women saw his naked head and ran off screaming, scared of this hairless person. None of them had ever seen a hairless person before. Nappy slowly reached up and touched his head, and he almost broke into a run, too. He felt nothing but naked skin on his head. This was a bit embarrassing for Nappy. He didn't know how to act or what to do. So he acted like a crazy person, screaming and hollering, running here and there. The women took off in many directions, far away from this dangerous person. When Nappy was out of sight, far away from the camp, he slowed down and became himself again, so that he could get a better feeling of his head. He knew that he was plumb bald and that he would have to stay out of sight for a long time until all his hair grew back. That is what he did, and from then on, he never trusted mice with anything anymore. The end.
Reg told this story to illustrate that there are rules associated with oral traditions, and when we don't understand or follow those rules, we run into problems. So the old people would say we're in this ceremony and anybody wanting to come in needs to follow our rules. That's why we make the smudge and talk about our rules. And if they're going to come, they need to be aware. And if they don't follow our rules, they're going to be crazy like Nappy and everybody's going to laugh at them when things go wrong for them. Some Indigenous making and conflict resolution processes are rooted in storytelling and oral delivery methods and are set within a decision-making circle. The decision-making circle has rules and protocols that should be followed, and it provides an opportunity for participants to share their knowledge and experiences. It often includes storytelling, singing, and dancing. All people who participate in a decision-making circle have been chosen because of their role or position in a community, or for the relationship with the person who requires a decision. Through our discussions with Reg, we came to understand some basic components of an Indigenous worldview, drawing from examples he provided from a Blackfoot perspective. This understanding prompted us to consider the Western worldview that the AER predominantly works within, a worldview explored in the following section.
My name's Corrine Lawrence. I'm with Alberta Stakeholder Engagement. Western written systems. Parallel to an oral system is a written system, predominantly a product of Western societies. Reg shared with us what the elders in his community talk about when they think of a Western worldview as embodied by a written system. Reg spoke of the days preceding the treaties signed by First Nations and what is now Canada, and what those events, along with the residential school teachings, led elders to perceive as the Western worldview. The elders observe that the premise of a Western worldview is that of dominion, with humans as superior to all creations, with knowledge shared through written systems in a hierarchical structure, and with authority being grounded in ownership and authenticated through documents, permits, and certificates. The AER is an example of the structures resulting from Western written systems. Our current governance, education, science, and decision-making processes are manifestations of a system that has historically followed colonial governments as they settled into new areas of the world. Western civilization relies heavily on written documents to administer the system. We have instituted instruments such as legal documents, legislative acts, and constitutions that empower our civilization to maintain our worldview and provide order and structure in our society. If a Western worldview is premised on dominion and a written system, in contrast to an Indigenous worldview premised on equality and an oral system, how do we find ways to work together? We examine the link or the connection through an exploration of ethical spaces.
This is Carol Covey. I work in major projects at the AER, Linkages and Ethical Spaces. Voices of Understanding is about creating connections, about linkages that generate a new way of working together within an ethical space. Through our discussions with Reg, we established a foundational understanding of worldviews and sought to understand how Indigenous and Western worldviews can be linked. Reg encouraged us to really think about what linking means and reminded us that we are not seeking to either incorporate or integrate components of worldviews when he said the following. We tend to mix stories or oral traditions with written documents. And when we take stories with written documents, we get confused because we combine them. We need to pull the stories apart from written documents because written documents is the Western concept of collecting data, collecting information, collecting knowledge, and it is stored in written documentation. The parallel to an oral culture is the data, the knowledge, and what's happening in the environment. That information is stored in our stories, these packages that are called stories. Attempts to either incorporate or integrate Indigenous processes and knowledge with mainstream institutions and ways of doing business have been repeated through different initiatives and forums. These attempts have had limited success or have created confusion, or both. Such an approach is often referred to as incorporation and can be illustrated as shown on page 13 in the book. A story Reg shared with us about cultural confusion involved a memory that he has from his time in residential school. He told us he entered residential school when he was 5, and when he started school, he came with an understanding of math that was grounded in his worldview. Reg spoke of being part of the Blackfoot Littlebirds and the Chickadee societies when he was young, and that when he had completed his learning in those societies, he was given a song. The song represented his certificate of proof that he had completed those levels, like a report card. Later, when he was moved to residential school, he tried to use his songs in math class to demonstrate that he understood numbers and formulas and how to calculate his answers. The Blackfoot language couldn't be understood by the English-speaking teachers, and the concept of singing knowledge versus showing it by writing down numbers and formulas couldn't be reconciled with the institution of a residential school. Reg used this example to illustrate cultural confusion, the result of trying to make an Indigenous oral system work with a Western written system, which is also sometimes referred to as integration, and can be illustrated as shown on page 14 in the book. If we were going to avoid the cultural confusion that flows from the incorporation of integration of worldviews, we need to know how we can authentically link parallel systems. When we asked Reg how to do this, he provided us with a few examples of protocols for meetings as discussed below. These examples reflect two concepts or two ways of linking systems: cultural translation and cultural interpretation. The first example Reg gave us related to a gavel, the small hammer or mallet that is often used in governance to start proceedings. In a Western thought process, we may think of a gavel as signifying the start of a meeting. It is a call to order. There is a cultural question to be asked about this. When engaging in oral culture, it would be appropriate to ask, how do you call to order your gatherings? And the response may be, a smudge is our call to order. A ceremony or meeting may start with a purifying smudge. Smudging is the burning of medicinal plants to create smoke. Often the smoke is swept over the head and body to cleanse and balance those participating in an event. Sage, sweetgrass, tobacco, and cedar are common plants used for smudging. Reg described smudging as a process to validate what is true and called it an oral policy. Smudging is how knowledge can be accessed, similar to how a written policy may provide knowledge or guidance to a reader. Here lies the link. By asking a cultural question about a call to order, a gavel and a smudge are identified. For this example, the cultural translation is to connect the smudge to the gavel. The cultural interpretation is to recognize that they are both a call to order. In a practical context, we now have linked a call to order. A similar point can be illustrated through a consideration of a gathering space. Perhaps a boardroom is a typical meeting place for some, and for others, a teepee is a common gathering place. The cultural question about this would be, what is your gathering place when you need to make important decisions? The cultural translation is to connect the boardrooms to teepees as gathering places. However, both a boardroom and a teepee are more than spaces. They have expectations of protocols that must be understood. For example, most aspects of a boardroom, the booking of a meeting, running of the meeting, attendees and their roles, and minute-taking are understood in an organization. In other words, putting a group of people into a room with a large table does not create a boardroom. The protocols are absent. The cultural interpretation is to recognize that both a teepee and a boardroom reflect the venue where decisions are made. Thus, we have linked another aspect of decision-making, that of gathering place and associated protocols. Gathering place became a very tangible link for the AER. The ceremony for the knowledge transfer that preceded this book included a traditional pipe ceremony, held in a circle format inside a boardroom. The AER logo, the Canadian and provincial flags, and other items that represent our sources of authority and influences were present alongside the symbols of authority and influence that Reg brought to the gathering, such as a pipe and drums. We shared the space, we talked about the protocols, and brought together people who had a common understanding of the purpose, and in doing so, we created a link. As we reflected on what Reg shared with us, and discussed our differing interpretations, we came to realize what he meant by a link, or an ethical space. Reg described ethical space as a way of thinking and acting that links the world views of Indigenous and Western cultures. He said, "We can use circles, and these circles represent ethical principles that both cultures have, the written culture and the oral culture. They have ethical principles that link these two cultures together. Whatever comes out of the circle are foundations we can work from to find solutions when we get together to have hearings and mediations, and that way we're recognizing the oral and written system by linking them together. We don't want to combine them together because we'll get culturally confused. We need to pull them apart and link them together, and that sitting in this ethical space, that ethical space is our link. That's our foundation to get together and have a discussion." An ethical space reflects a new way of thinking, a new way of doing things, and it doesn't diminish what already exists. Both a Western written culture and an Indigenous oral culture are distinct, with unique practices. Reg told us that each culture can bring practices forward that together set the fundamental principles for how to move ahead, resulting in an ethical space, a place of cultural safety. It can be illustrated as shown on page 16 in the book. During one of our conversations with Reg, we asked if we had illustrated the concept of ethical space correctly, and he confirmed that we had. We didn't ask Reg about the overlapping space where Western and ethical space connect, or where Indigenous culture and ethical space connect. We didn't ask because we assumed that these overlaps reflected some confusion that would naturally occur when we tried to figure out what ethical spaces look like, and how we would interact in those spaces. So we sat in silence for a moment thinking about these overlaps and fearing that confusion would be a constant issue if we navigate this journey of trying to understand how to work together. In response to the silence, Reg answered the question we never asked. That space between a Western written culture and ethical space represents a code of conduct or values reflected in Western culture, organizations, and individuals. For the AER, this could be represented by the Code of Conduct and Ethics for the Public Service of Alberta, written in February 22, 2017. For individuals interacting in a non-work environment, perhaps the beliefs or the values that guide daily interactions that demonstrate respect for others are represented by this overlapping space. Reg told us that the overlapping space where an Indigenous oral culture and ethical space connect is a reflection of the ethical values or seven sacred teachings discussed earlier in this section. In Blackfoot culture, these teachings are reflected in stories. Similar stories that validate the seven sacred teachings are found in Cree, Sioux, Ojibwe, Inuit, and the other Indigenous cultures. When we link Western and Indigenous cultures, we bring the principles of each culture together to create an ethical space that reflects the values of both. Through our work with Reg, we came to realize that we need to move away from trying to incorporate or integrate Indigenous perspectives into our work. This results in cultural confusion. Instead, we need to work together to create a new space, an ethical space that is culturally safe. We don't entirely know what this will look like, and that is part of the journey. It is with this understanding that we were able to move forward and delve into the details of what we were learning. These details are explored in the next section of this book, which discuss decision-making models and processes.
Decision-making models and processes. How do we learn? What structures and processes support our learning? When we were children, our parents may have read to us, showed us things, and told us what we needed to know. As we grew, the school system provided the structure, the people, and the materials to guide our education. Perhaps, along with that, we had grandparents or other people in our life who told us stories about their childhood or adult experiences. Stories that enriched our understanding of the world, our families, or our community. As adults in a workplace setting, we can access training and opportunities provided by our employers or externally that support our personal or professional growth. These models and processes support our learning and can be culturally specific. Such culturally specific models are further examined in this section. What follows are an overview of the decision-making circles that Reg described and which are founded on a four-part learning process, and a summary of key AER decision-making approaches, followed by a discussion about linkages. Decision-making models and processes. How do we learn? What structures and processes support our learning? When we were children, our parents may have read to us, showed us things, and told us what we needed to know. As we grew, the school system provided the structure, the people, and the materials to guide our education. Perhaps, along with that, we had grandparents or other people in our life who told us stories about their childhood or adult experiences. Stories that enriched our understanding of the world, our families, or our community. As adults in a workplace setting, we can access training and opportunities provided by our employers or externally that support our personal or professional growth. These models and processes support our learning and can be culturally specific. Such culturally specific models are further examined in this section. What follows are an overview of the decision-making circles that Reg described and which are founded on a four-part learning process, and a summary of key AER decision-making approaches, followed by a discussion about linkages.
Decision-making models and processes. How do we learn? What structures and processes support our learning? When we were children, our parents may have read to us, showed us things, and told us what we needed to know. As we grew, the school systems provided the structure, the people, and the materials to guide our education. Perhaps, along with that, we had grandparents or other people in our life who told us stories about their childhood or adult experiences, stories that enriched our understanding of the world, our families, or our community. As adults in a workplace setting, we can access training and opportunities provided by our employers or externally that support our personal and professional growth. These models and processes support our learning and can be culturally specific. Such culturally specific models are further examined in this section. What follows are an overview of the decision-making circles that Reg described and which are founded on a four-part learning process, and a summary of key AER decision-making approaches, followed by a discussion about linkages. Indigenous decision-making circles. The AER sought Reg's guidance on how decision-making circles work so that we could consider how to link our models and processes with those of Indigenous communities and create a new space, an ethical space. Before considering decision-making circles, Reg encouraged us to first ground what we were going to learn in the four basic concepts of an Indigenous oral system. The learning process in an oral system. Embedded in the circle process are four learning components: venue, language, action, and song. Reg shared with us that these stories are repeatedly told by parents, grandparents, and elders, and that these stories teach important lessons that are passed from generation to generation within a structured decision-making circle process. Reg explained to us that the oral traditions have a validation process, or a way of proving that what is being said is true. A traditional Piikani Blackfoot process has four parts: venue, action, language, and song. So if I say I belong to the Thunderpipe Society, for example, I need to be able to identify myself to the Thunderpipe community in those four ways. I need to be able to sit in their venues, to demonstrate my ability and qualifications through certain actions. I need to speak their language and sing those Thunderpipe songs that give that authority. If I can't do all those with respect and understanding, then I can't be part of their society or discourse. This is how we would protect or give authority to information or to a concept. Reg provided a table and photos to represent the four components of the learning process in an oral system, as shown on page 20 and 21 of the book. To illustrate how the four components of an Indigenous learning process would interact, Reg provided an example of how one becomes recognized as her traditional healer. If I was given a plant to heal with, the user of that plant would come together because they own the song, and I would go into the venue and ask. Secondly, I would go into that venue and I would prove myself with that plant to say that I know how to use this plant. That's the action. Third is language, and that's where the stories are so important. I can tell the story of that plant and creation story and the story of how it comes to be a medicine. After they test me and I pass the test and I'm sanctioned, then I'm given a song from their society, a society song that says, yes, he's proven himself and now he's a healer with that plant. So in the oral culture, when I go out in the community and people ask me about the plant, I would say that the healing component of this plant were given to me, and here's my song. Once I sing my song, it's like showing my degree or in my piece of paper that says, this is how I got it. And that's validation. In an oral culture, that's how we validate person, place, thing, and story. Through venue, action, language, and song. The learning process in an oral system is founded on the components of venue, action, language, and song. This learning process validates what is truth and allows knowledge to be passed on to others in a manner that does not require a written document as evidence of that knowledge. Venue, action, language, and song are presented in decision-making models, as illustrated by the following discussion of Blackfoot decision-making circles.
Blackfoot decision-making circles. With an understanding of the learning process that is a foundation of decision-making, Ridge shared with us an overview of the Blackfoot model for decision-making. In Blackfoot communities, ceremonial bundles play a central role in decision-making circles. These bundles, present at traditional ceremonies, contain cultural materials wrapped in a special cloth. The bundles have physical and abstract components. The objects inside the bundle and the associated songs and prayers to be performed at the decision-making circle, as well as instructions on how the bundle should be handled and what kinds of taboos are associated with it. Bundles are an important component of decision-making circles. They represent authority. A person who needs a decision to be made in a decision-making circle makes a vow to the bundle to accept and carry out whatever decisions are made during the decision-making circle ceremony. In essence, these bundles are the physical and abstract manifestation of the traditional Blackfoot belief and social system. There are many different types of bundles, each having a particular function. The one associated with the decision-making circle is called the Thunder Medicine Pipe Bundle. In the original story of how the bundle was created, the spirit Thunder gave a pipe to the first owner in a vision and relayed instructions for the accompanying songs and dances, which sounded like thunder. One of the disciplinary actions associated with this bundle was severe punishment, including death, if an individual disobeyed the decision or agreement made at the historical pipe bundle decision-making circle. Each bundle has two stewards, called bundle keepers, who commit to properly taking care of the bundle, including unwrapping and handling all parts of it during a ceremony. Bundle keepers carry the responsibility of being knowledge carriers and of ensuring that the ceremony is practiced correctly, thus maintaining not only an important tradition, but also the well-being of their community. Bundle keepers have high status in their communities and are today regarded respectfully as elders. In a decision-making circle, bundle keepers play a role as either ceremonialists or advisors. Bundles can be transferred from one set of bundle keepers to the next in a transfer ceremony. The transfer ceremony is a process of certification by peers, which, once achieved, give the owner specific authority. A Blackfoot decision-making circle is facilitated by a pipe ceremony. A community member who requires a decision be made gives tobacco to the Thunder Medicine Pipe Bundle Keepers. These bundle keepers are two individuals who have the transferred right to guide the process. Reg asked that we continue to reinforce the details of Blackfoot decision-making circles and to highlight the modifications to the traditional circle that account for modern decision-making. Pages 24 and 25 of the book provide a modified illustration of a traditional and a modern decision-making circle as shared by Reg in the book Agaxjiman, a Blackfoot framework for decision-making and mediation process, and in supplemental discussions. These two examples identify the key role and positions within a traditional decision-making circle and how they have been translated for Western applications. Many of the roles and responsibilities of participants have been adapted for modern issues. For instance, there are not necessarily specific male and female roles. Sometimes the tobacco cutter might become the record keeper, and the drummer's position might be filled by people who represent supporting organizations. Reg provided comparisons of the roles within traditional and modern decision-making circles, as shown on pages 24 and 25 of the book.
Process 4, Decision-Making Circle. Protocols and processes guide circle decision-making. Reg shared with us that steps are taken when making a decision using the modern decision-making circle. While describing this to us, Reg sometimes used terminology applicable to a traditional decision-making circle and thus demonstrated the connection between these historical and contemporary approaches. Number 1. The ceremonialist, similar to the organization facilitator in a modern decision-making circle, enters the circle structure. Once this person reaches the defined position, he or she welcomes participants. The ceremonialist then assigns seating and defines roles and responsibilities. Number 2. Directly after the smudge or the opening statement, the co-ceremonialist, similar to a facilitator, states the mandate of the bundle. He or she ensures that the decision-making circle meets the purpose of the bundle and will interrupt the circle process if necessary. 3. The organization host, who wants a decision to be made, makes a vow by placing tobacco with the bundle and explains why a decision was requested. He or she asks the ceremonialist to facilitate and begin the circle decision-making process. The mandate co-host represents an opposing view to that of the organization host. The ceremonialist has the option to either burn sweet grass or a smudge to start the process or make an opening statement. Number 5. The ceremonialist then defines the rules for the decision-making circle. 6. The decision-making circle usually involves 2 rounds of discussion. The first round begins with a discussion of the issues behind the organization host's request. The organization host, who made the request for the decision-making circle, begins the discussion, followed by organization support, then the other mandate co-host, and finally the mandate co-support. 7. After the first round, the organization facilitator and recorder sum up the general parameters of the discussion and present priority issues identified in the discussion. 8. A second round of discussion looks for solutions based on the issues identified in round 1, with the desired outcome of resolving the conflict between the organization host and the mandate co-host. Discussions follow the same order as in the first round of the decision-making circle. 9. After the second round, the ceremonialist and the recorder sum up the general parameters of the discussion and present solutions reflected by the discussion. 10. After consensus has been reached, the ceremonialist directs the implementation of the consensus. There are an average of 2 rounds of discussion. However, if agreement can't be reached, a 3rd round may be required. 11. The decision-making circle ends with a ceremonialist and his or her supporters singing a song. Indigenous decision-making models, as described by Reg, facilitate community-based decisions, and while grounded in tradition, they are used in contemporary settings. These consensus-based models give everyone who participated in the process a chance to have a say. Each Indigenous community will have its own version of a decision-making model. All decision-making models have protocols and processes that determine the appropriate position and duties of each individual participating in the ceremony. For example, Reg described the teepee floor plan as shaping the ceremonial positions and proceedings for both the traditional and modern decision-making circles, and it is for this reason that the word circle is used to describe the model. Reg acknowledged that other models are used in Indigenous communities. He referred to the use of longhouses, half-circle, and triangle configurations as representing the diversity of venues and models. Returning to his discussion of the process for a decision-making circle, Reg described decision-making circles as being based on community participation with value placed on each individual's voice. People must be willing to learn and take on the responsibilities that come with a specific position in the circle. They are also accountable for supporting and implementing the decision that is reached. Reg shared information about his community and emphasized that it has always returned to the decision-making circle to bring the community together. The Aboriginal decision-making process is naturally limitless in its scope and was used for all issues, Reg said. This book will help foster the return to decision-making circles to the community, very much like the traditional ways to keep harmony among Aboriginal people. The decision-making circle shows that the positions within the circle are interdependent and interactive to enable consensus and to solve problems. Hand in hand with an analysis of Blackfoot decision-making circles and the associated roles and processes is a comparison of the AER's decision-making models. Two models, for hearings and for alternative dispute resolution, are summarized in the following section.
AER decision-making models. Reg encouraged us to reflect on how the AER makes decisions and on what a Western learning system might be and how it relates to our decision-making models.
The learning process in a written system. Reg described a learning process in a Western system that parallels that of an oral system. He spoke of an analogy to a Western system where a boardroom, motions, discourse, and the passing of a resolution reflect venue, action, language, and song. These aspects are reflected in the AER's decision-making models and in the governing system that the AER operates under. Energy resource development in Alberta is regulated by the AER. The AER provides for the safe, efficient, orderly, and environmentally responsible development of energy resources. This includes allocating and conserving water resources, managing public lands, and protecting the environment while securing their economic benefits for all Albertans. To ensure that this activity is safe, environmentally responsible, and closely managed, the Government of Alberta has granted the AER authority to review and make decisions on proposed energy developments, oversee all aspects of energy resource activities in accordance with government policies, regularly inspect energy activities to ensure that all applicable requirements are met, penalize companies that fail to comply with AER requirements, and hold hearings on proposed energy developments. The AER's authority for energy-related development only includes the Environmental Protection and Enhancement Act, EPEA, including reclamation and remediation activities, and the Water Act. The AER is also responsible for public lands and geophysical activities under the Public Lands Act and the Mines and Minerals Act. The AER regulates through adjudication and regulation. A company must file an application with the AER before it can proceed with an energy development, such as a well, pipeline, or production facility. Before filing the application, the company must first notify people who may be directly and adversely affected by the application, such as Indigenous peoples, landowners, occupants, and trappers within a defined area near the company's proposed development. This allows potentially affected parties to discuss their concerns and issues with the company and have the opportunity to have those concerns addressed and, if possible, resolved. When concerns cannot be resolved, a hearing may be required before the AER makes a decision on the application. Indigenous people, individuals, groups, associations, and companies that object to a proposed development or to some aspect of a proposed development may file a statement of concern. The AER then examines the information submitted by both the company, the applicant, and those that filed statements of concern. The AER may decide to hold a hearing to make a decision on the project.
Hi, I'm Dean Campbell with the Hearing Services team at the AER. An AER hearing is a formal process that gives parties an opportunity to present and test evidence. It is a public forum with rules and procedures that all participants must follow. Anyone may attend to observe a hearing, but only those allowed to participate can take part in the hearing. A hearing panel usually has three AER hearing commissioners. One of the three panel members acts as the chair of the hearing. The panel members sit at the front of the hearing room, facing the participants. The participants often have lawyers, support staff, and others who may act as witnesses, such as technical experts and landowners. A court reporter attends the hearing to transcribe the oral hearing into a written transcript. The hearing panel can only make its decision based on the record. The hearing follows a process similar to a legal court. It is designed so that every party has a chance to provide evidence, listen to the other party's evidence, ask questions of the other parties, and present arguments to the hearing panel. It typically follows a process such as this. First, the panel chair opens the hearing by stating the purpose and introducing the hearing panel, AER counsel, and AER staff. Hearing participants then come forward and register. The panel chair explains how the hearing will be conducted and deals with any preliminary matters. Next, all the witnesses must be sworn in or affirmed before giving evidence. They are asked to promise that they will tell the truth. There are a variety of ways to be sworn in or affirmed, according to different belief or cultural practices. Next, the applicant or the parties bring forward. Next, the applicant or the party bringing the issue forward to the AER is the first to present evidence. The applicant and its witnesses sit at the witness table. The applicant explains the project and may also have expert witnesses to present technical evidence. Following that, each hearing participant in turn can question, which means to cross-examine, the applicant's witnesses. Disagreeing parties can cross-examine the opposing side. The questioning tests the evidence both parties have provided. The hearing panel listens to how the witnesses answer questions. This helps the panel decide whether they can rely on the evidence, and it helps them to find the best evidence to use for their decision. AER staff and the hearing panel may also ask questions, but they do not cross-examine. This is because the AER is neutral and does not oppose or support either side. Their questions are used to clarify evidence or to gather missing information. When questioning of the applicant is complete, the first participant and its witnesses sit at the witness table to provide their evidence. Participants may speak for themselves and may have a witness panel or expert witnesses. The participant is cross-examined by the applicant, then can be questioned by AER staff and the hearing panel in that order. Each participant in turn follows the same process until all of them have presented their evidence and have been questioned. After the evidence is given, the applicant and participants make their final arguments or statements to the panel. The applicant has the last chance to reply. The panel chair then closes the hearing, and the panel has 90 days to issue a written decision. The hearing panel takes this time to carefully consider all the evidence submitted by the parties and write a report giving reasons for the decision. The decision, including any conditions, is the final decision of the AER and can only be appealed to the Court of Appeal of Alberta. Indigenous communities regularly participate in AER hearings. Some of the ways that the AER and Indigenous communities have worked together to try to create an ethical space include holding hearing sessions in First Nation communities, swearing in or affirming witnesses in a manner that reflects cultural preferences, such as the use of community-specific objects. Supporting Indigenous ceremonies before, after, or as part of the hearing. Facilitating the participation of elder panels as witnesses in a hearing. Providing translation services for Indigenous speakers based on preferences identified through discussions with communities. Inviting the holders of Indigenous knowledge to participate in the hearing, and also reflecting Indigenous knowledge in hearing decisions. The planning of a hearing with an Indigenous community is an example of the possibilities associated with an ethical space. Meaningful dialogue is required to make the process work for the hearing panel and for the community. Preparing for a hearing and navigating the hearing process with the intention of creating ethical space provides the opportunity for AER decisions to reflect the perspective that Indigenous communities provide during a hearing.
Alternative Dispute Resolution. The AER's Alternative Dispute Resolution Program, or ADR program, was developed in response to the desire of stakeholders and Indigenous communities to be more directly involved in and have more control in resolving energy-related disputes. The AER's ADR program helps parties resolve disputes pertaining to energy matters regulated by the AER. ADR is not a prescriptive program and can include a variety of approaches, including facilitated meetings or mediation. ADR is adaptable, and mediation has some natural parallels in Indigenous decision-making circles. Leslie Allen from Alberta Stakeholder Engagement describes CIRCLE process like this. CIRCLE is so simple and yet has a profound impact on how we show up together. When we change the chairs, we change the conversation. In CIRCLE, each of us has a critical role on the rim from where we co-create our center, setting the intention for our gathering. CIRCLE calls us to hold space and bear witness for each other. It invites vulnerability and humility to our conversation and allows us to see each other and our situations in a new way. The primary goal of ADR is to help parties explore and understand each other's interests and, together, develop acceptable solutions. Another important goal is to restore working relationships. Even though the AER encourages parties to first attempt to cooperatively reach agreement prior to requesting assistance from the AER's ADR team, in cases of dispute, use of the ADR program will be considered. A mediator facilitates the process and does not make decisions for participants. The AER has both staff and hearing commissioners who are mediators. ADR can be used before a company applies to the AER, during the application review process, prior to a hearing with a hearing commissioner, for operational disputes, and for disputes over reclamation.
Process for involvement in ADR. ADR can be triggered at any time throughout the life cycle of a project regulated by the AER. An individual or community can inquire about ADR at any point, and a statement of concern does not need to be filed to advance ADR. If a statement of concern is submitted to the AER, a reply letter will be sent providing the relevant contact information and information about ADR. In some cases, AER field centers or reclamation officers may identify conflict between a company and a community or an individual and may suggest that ADR be considered. The steps involved in alternative dispute resolution are as follows. 1. The AER identifies an opportunity for alternative dispute resolution, or a relevant party expresses an interest in alternative dispute resolution. 2. The AER reaches out to affected parties and confirms their interest and willingness to participate in it and confirms what needs to be resolved. 3. The AER mediator meets individually with the participants to understand their perspectives and to gather background information. These meetings help participants prepare for alternative dispute resolution. 4. The ADR session begins with an introductory discussion. When the parties first meet, the mediator sets a collaborative environment where the participants are welcomed and introduce themselves. The mediator explores the nuts and bolts of the process with the parties and helps the participants as they set appropriate guidelines for their communication and decision making. 5. Following introductions, the draft agenda is discussed and the issues to be resolved are clarified. The mediator listens to the participants and neutrally communicates the issues the participants identify. 6. Using open-ended exploratory questions, the mediator guides a deep exchange of the participants' perspectives and interests, needs, fears, concerns, hopes. related to the specific issues. Goal is mutual understanding using conversation, not debate. Focused listening is encouraged. Ideally, the participants begin to see common ground and create solutions. 7. Should resolution be achieved? The parties often choose to develop an agreement that identifies what they have agreed to. These agreements are between the parties, and while the mediator may help the parties identify agreement terms, the final agreement is not shared with the AER. 8. Post-meeting support is provided by the AER if requested by either party. 9. A post-mediation evaluation is provided to the participants should they wish to provide feedback on their experience with alternative dispute resolution. Reg prompted us to think about why First Nations may not participate in an alternative dispute resolution, or why alternative dispute resolution involving Indigenous communities may not have had the outcomes we might expect. He said that if we want to address this, we have to give First Nations cultural safety and to create a mandate that supports both sides. Without this joint mandate, there is a belief that the mediator or the AER will use their authority to facilitate a decision that does not consider First Nations interest. As Reg said, if you can look through a mediation window and can link joint mandates and parallel structures, then you can build trust. Some of the ways we are seeking to reflect Reg's guidance and work better with Indigenous communities in an alternative dispute resolution process are as follows. Recognizing that wisdom can be accessed through storytelling, and that the relevance of the story will be revealed in time. Using transformative mediation, where the focus is not established through an agenda, but rather we go where the parties need to go in terms of the topics that are discussed. Acknowledging and creating space for the multiple layers of decision makers and processes in Indigenous communities, including youth, elders, elected officials, and other representatives. Broadening the agenda of an alternative dispute resolution session to include unresolvable items such as treaty rights or residential schools. Recognizing that such topics provide contacts and support relationships. Changing our language by moving away from mediation speech. Investing time in building the relationships and trust needed for alternative dispute resolution to reflect the interests and approaches of Indigenous communities. We are learning that a prescriptive approach to alternative dispute resolution does not support the participation of Indigenous communities. As we continue to work with Indigenous communities and apply what Reg and other knowledge holders are teaching us, we will seek to create ethical spaces where disputes can be resolved in a manner that all parties can feel comfortable with.
Linkages, looking through the window. When considering the links between learning processes and decision-making models, Reg encouraged us to compare decision-making circles with the AER's decision-making models, such as hearings and ADR, with the intention of finding parallels. An understanding of these parallels strengthens our view through the window. When we look at what is going to strengthen that window, on AER's side, they have ethical values. On our traditional side, we have seven sacred teachings. They're the same, and that's what strengthens that window. So when we start looking at joint mandates that'll help strengthen that window, that's what's going to make that window real. If you can link the structure, then that foundation is going to get strong because we'll just automatically recognize the joint mandate that exists. the ethical values that exist on both sides. Reg encouraged us to think about the learning processes in an oral and a written system, and the decision-making models in each system, and find the linkages that open the door to an ethical space. Our analysis is captured in Appendix B, Comparing Learning Processes, and Appendix C, Decision-Making Models, Examining Linkages, where we consider hearings, ADR, and decision-making circles. This is not a conclusive exercise, but rather an illustration of how we will continue to challenge ourselves to examine our approaches in relation to those of Indigenous communities, and we encourage others to do the same.
As the province's single energy regulator, we are moving away from assessing oil and gas development applications in isolation to looking at proposed activities within the context of all development in an area, the environmental capacity, the economic opportunities, and the social values and expectations of those who live, work, and play in an area. This expands our life cycle approach to development. A life cycle approach to development means overseeing all aspects of oil and gas development from application through to end of life, reclamation. It also means engaging with Indigenous peoples earlier to understand what matters to them and to ensure that they have an influential voice in how we regulate. They want to know more about what is going on, where development will occur, how it will happen, and how it affects them. Through a series of pilot projects and initiatives, the AER is exploring an alternate regulatory approach to large-scale and complex development activities. Doing this requires input on how people affected by energy development want and need to work together to arrive at a common understanding of the concerns about energy development and to jointly develop solutions to address those concerns. Engaging Indigenous communities in this regard and in a manner reflective of what we have learned from Voices of Understanding is certainly a work in progress. Often we have heard from communities, "Show me, don't tell me." We need to walk the talk and demonstrate our understanding through actions. During the time this book was being written, we had the opportunity to apply some of our new understanding. We were in the midst of reaching out to stakeholders and Indigenous communities for participation in a project and noted that the level of interest from Indigenous communities was very low. We stepped back to evaluate what needed to change if we were going to honor Voices of Understanding and decided to be open to hearing what was making it difficult for communities to engage with us in this project. Indigenous communities told us we needed an approach that linked the AER's engagement framework to an Indigenous framework based in an oral tradition. From there, together, the AER and local Indigenous communities worked to create an Indigenous community panel as a forum for moving forwards together. Below are some of the things we did to help us advance our understanding, looking through the window, and eventually achieve trust and cultural safety, and to help us venture into the realm of an ethical space where both a Western and an Indigenous worldview interact equally. We weren't rigid in our approach. We met informally with communities and individuals to share understandings and to identify interests. We were open to hearing about and discussing historical issues that created a low trust environment between the AER and Indigenous communities. We discussed decision-making models and how an Indigenous worldview approach leads to complementary decision-making and how this approach restores and enhances the relationship between Indigenous peoples and the AER. We honored community values and recognized that our priorities didn't always align. We participated in cultural awareness sessions to support our development of knowledge and skills conducive to working with Indigenous communities. We recognized Indigenous traditions through adherence to protocol. We participated in ceremony and smudge to promote accountability to one another and to demonstrate a humble approach to engagement. We held each other accountable through a joint commitment statement that was developed in collaboration with all participants. Thus far, our experiences with the Indigenous Community Panel have prompted discussions about what is needed to achieve mutually beneficial outcomes, and about how to do so in a way that allows for action and communication in an ethical space where oral and written systems are recognized. As we started to grasp this concept of linking, we struggled with how we capture an oral tradition in a written book and reflect the cultural richness of what we were learning from Reg. Reg shared with us some of his thoughts about this using a series of drawings showing Western decision-making on one side and Blackfoot decision-making on the other. He called these management systems that have associated organizational structures, information sources, and processes. He then showed us the parallels between them.
As we started to grasp this concept of linking, we struggled with how we capture an oral tradition in a written book and reflect the cultural richness of what we were learning from Reg. Reg shared with us some of his thoughts about this using a series of drawings showing Western decision-making on one side and Blackfoot decision-making on the other. He called these management systems that have associated organizational structures, information sources, and processes. He then showed us the parallels between them.
Organizational structures. To ground our understanding, Reg started with something that we could easily relate to, a typical organizational structure. He drew a diagram of a top-down organizational structure, and while he was drawing, he explained that from his perspective, this typified a Western organization. Parallel to a typical Western organizational structure is that of an oral culture. See page 47 for the illustration. As illustrated by the Western written system graphic, this type of organization has leadership concentrated at the top of the structure, with subordinates reporting to leaders. The organization may be divided by expertise, function, or geography, and the parts connect at a leadership level, but are predominantly standalone entities. Reg observed that there are processes that support this type of structure. If external information is being presented to the organization, it generally needs to work its way up through the management system in a hierarchical manner, which is usually an internally focused exercise. While a Western system, the AER only somewhat mirrors Reg's description. Groups are connected by informal relationships or formal processes to support information flow. Decisions can be made at various levels within the AER, not only at the senior leadership level. Leadership delegates decision makers throughout the organization. Parallel to a typical Western organizational structure is the structure of an oral culture. As illustrated by the Indigenous Oral System graphic, Reg presented a circle decision-making model similar to what is described earlier in this book. In this type of organization, experts feed into the entire system at multiple points, and while there are specified roles and responsibilities, information flow is primarily unrestricted. Both management systems reflect a mandate, or the key purpose the organization is trying to fulfill. Reg Crowshoe said, "The model used to deliver the mandate in both systems can be understood through the learning processes of venue, action, language, and song." He said, "It doesn't matter what the story is or in what individual Indigenous community. You can access the mandate through the process of venue, action, language, and song. This is what connects all Indigenous oral communities and what can link to the Western worldview. When you can draw the parallels between the actions, the venue, the language, and the song, then you, because you have navigated the processes appropriately, can make shared decisions." This is our challenge, to find the learning process in each worldview. Reg didn't tell us what the venue, action, language, and song aspects of each system, as illustrated above, are. Our journey includes figuring this out with each Indigenous community we work with.
Information sources. Reg encouraged us to think about the information sources that guide decision-making within Western and oral management systems. Information often takes the form of data, budgets, expert opinions, analysis of existing programs, and evaluation of potential new activities. We noticed that most information flowed through in materials such as briefing notes or business case presentation, which includes supporting data and metrics. In an oral system, information is usually gathered exclusively from the external environment. What is happening to people, to animals, to the Earth's resources is the information an Indigenous community will validate to inform decision-making processes. Reg illustrated our discussions with the two drawings on page 49. Within both systems, we can see that information in various forms influences the decisions that are made.
Processes. As the overarching graphic Reg was creating began to unfold, he elaborated on his thoughts and explained aspects of the management systems he was illustrating. Reg explained that the management systems weren't just graphics identifying roles and information sources. They also represented a process that addressed information flow and decision making. Reg asked us how information comes into our organization, and he spoke about an environmental situation being an input into our organization and how that information flows to our leadership and its advisors. Following that, the output, being the decision or information to be conveyed, is externally communicated through subject matter experts. Reg then discussed a process within an Indigenous oral system wherein a sensor story reflective of the external environment is brought into the circle and provided to the assessors by following protocols. The decision flowing from this process would be conveyed by effectors. He illustrated this point by challenging us to think of the cultural question associated with these parallel processes. My cultural question would be, how do you get into management control? On the Indigenous side, I'm going to be a sensor to bring in information and offer tobacco to get into the management control. On the Western side, I'm going to determine if it is in my job description, and that will allow me to feed information into management control or leadership. Reg drew the following image on page 50 of the book to illustrate the information flow. In an oral system, there are sensors who convey situations from the environment, and there are assessors who assess the sensor stories to determine whether they are valid. Validation is a process that compares the information with existing stories within an oral tradition. Any changes resulting from the input of the sensors and the validation by the assessors are then communicated by effectors who create a new story to share. The same could be said for a Western system, where information comes into an organization and is validated against strategic plans and organizational norms and communicated through subject and technical experts.
Linkages. After explaining these two management systems, Reg took us through an exercise of identifying how we find the connections between the systems. Reg amalgamated his drawings, and together we generated the concept of parallel systems. A wall with a window and a door was added to the drawings, resulting in the image on page 51. Dean Campbell, senior hearing advisor at the AER, confirmed his understanding with Reg using a window and door analogy. I see we've got this wall with the Western and oral systems on either side. And what we're used to working... Okay. I see we've got this wall with the Western and oral systems on either side. And what we're used to is working on the Western side and tossing something over the wall every now and then wondering why it didn't work. So what I see now is that we're not trying to develop a process with this document or book, but an opening. We're trying to open a window on that wall so that we can see and understand the process that is going on. And maybe we can even get to the stage where we make a door that we can walk through because we know a little bit about what is going on and we can thus engage in a discussion. Reg elaborated on the door and window concepts as an approach to developing ethical spaces The window is an analogy for the cultural interpretation and translation necessary to know how things work on the other side of the wall for the other culture. Reg further explained that the concept of an ethical space could be the door. Seeing a door and having glimpsed the other side through the window, we want to walk through the door. Reg cautioned that you can't rush through the door. The door brings the two sides together. The door is providing the ethical space for the two sides to have the discussion.
Reg's father, Joe Croshew, worked with author Michael Ross to create the book Weasel Tale, Stories Told by Joe Croshew. In the book, a conversation between Joe and Michael is captured. Joe tells the author this: "Say, Mike, if the white people understand my native people, they will understand the way of the Indians in the future. In the future, we're all going to work together. The only difference is language. English and Blackfoot is different." For the AER, ethical space will require empathic engagement to understand it, which means we should not rush through the door. Ethical space is the place that provides the most opportunity to learn and to improve our relationships with each other. It is here that we have a foundation upon which to begin a dialogue between cultures and a way to link two worldviews without diminishing either.
Creating a new shared story. The concept of decision-making circles as a Blackfoot oral model with associated processes was shared with the AER from the perspective of Dr. Reg Croshew. Voices of Understanding explores the concepts shared by Dr. Reg Croshew and inspires the AER to link our work with culturally appropriate engagement processes that create ethical spaces. This has a transformative effect on the AER as it seeks to become more empathetic and inclusive in its regulatory mandate. By becoming aware of the Indigenous oral system of decision-making, the AER accepts that oral systems are valid. Most importantly, if we are going to reach mutually acceptable decisions, we have to look through the window and see the common ways in which decisions are made in Indigenous communities and in a Western regulatory framework. Then, in demonstrating respect, we can pass through the door and bridge decision-making processes to create a new space, an ethical space. On January 31st, Dr. Reg Croshew and three elders representing Treaty Areas 6, 7, and 8 hosted a ceremony attended by AER's executive leadership team and employees from across the organization to celebrate the second edition of Voices of Understanding. The event also ceremoniously granted the AER the right to use this shared knowledge. A storage package, or bundle, was presented to the AER by Dr. Reg Croshew. This bundle is held by our CEO, Jim Ellis, and tells a story as part of a process associated with the book Voices of Understanding. Our new story is partially captured here, in this book, and it is also captured in the bundle, which contains items associated with our journey. As Reg said, we tend to mix stories with written documents, and when we take stories with written documents, we get confused because we combine them. We need to pull the stories apart from written documents because written documents is the Western concept of collecting data, collecting information, collecting knowledge, and it's stored in written documentation. The parallel to an oral culture is the data, the knowledge, and what's happening in the environment. That information is stored in our stories, these packages that are called stories. So the story is the document and the storage package. This bundle does not symbolize completion, but rather a step further in our shared journey. The ceremony granted the AER the authority and rights to use the knowledge captured in this book and to carry Dr. Croshew's teachings forward in our work, a responsibility we are honored to accept. Voices of Understanding is, therefore, a living book. Our understandings will change as we begin to apply what we have learned to the AER's regulatory framework. This represents our journey to understanding. Reg taught us that songs validate stories, so we sought to figure out what song is associated with this book, the bundle, and our future work. Reg told us that our song is a smudge. If we work with a decision-making circle and smudge, we will have validated our knowledge through a cultural process. By doing this, we can build trust. This is our next step, to begin building trust with Indigenous communities based on an understanding of individual community processes and protocols. The AER is grateful to Dr. Reg Kroshu, who shared his knowledge and granted the AER the privilege of using that knowledge in the development of this book and the creation of our story. As a result of his teachings, the AER can bridge our decision-making models and processes with Indigenous decision-making models to more effectively deliver a regulatory process suitable to Indigenous communities and do so within an ethical space.